Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners all around the world? Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Today, we sit down with Obi Nwosu, co-founder and CEO of CoinFloor, a UK-based Bitcoin exchange. But first, let's check in with Swan. Swan continues to grow. We're really, really excited to be earning the business and recommendations of great Bitcoiners like Robert Breedlove, Lynn Alden, Max Kaiser, and many more of you. Jan Pritzker and team are working on some new features that we're really excited to announce soon. Stay tuned to our Twitter account, at SwanBitcoin. Really impressive to watch those guys operate. The dev design team are a small but powerful team of engineering Jedis. It's also just as impressive to watch Corey Clipston operate. I have never met a networker like him. He's a fantastic leader and runs the business the right way. It's really just an honor to be a part of this team. And you know, you are that Bitcoin person in your friends and family's lives. And our goal is to earn your recommendation so that when your friends and family are ready to start building their own stack, you feel you can trust Swan to treat them well and help you teach them what Bitcoin is all about. If you do decide to start recommending Swan to your friends and family, you should check out our referral program, the Swan Force. You can start up there at swanbitcoin.com/enlist. You'll get a custom landing page with your avatar and a message up at top, and you'll earn 25% of Swan's fees on every purchase made by your referrals when they choose a Swan membership. That's $50 a week or more. And you'll earn those that referral bonus, the 25%, for up to 3 years, and they get $10 of BTC, so of course everybody wins. You don't need to be in the United States to join Swan Force either. You can sign up US-based customers, and we'll pay you in sats wherever you are in the world. It's a fantastic deal. As always, thanks to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the podcast in their feed alongside some other great Bitcoin podcasts. LTBN is the original Bitcoin podcast network. Follow LTBN at LTB Network and subscribe to the feed at letstalkbitcoin.com. All right, let's go. Obi Nwosu is co-founder and CEO of CoinFloor, a UK-based Bitcoin exchange. CoinFloor was founded in early 2013, so Obi's been on the scene for a long time. In this episode, we talk about Obi's background, the founding and growth of CoinFloor. We get some history stories for Bitcoin. We dive into a bit of tech at the end. Obi has an engineering background, so he can definitely hang on the tech discussions. And Obi, you know, he's one of the good ones. He's a really cool dude, and it was a real treat to get to spend some time with him. I think you'll agree. All right, let's dive in.
Obi, it's also fun to sometimes have a conversation with someone who's just like, no, I don't believe in this.
Yeah, it is for sure.
But they're willing to sort of go through and sort of explain the logic of their view and hear the logic of yours, and vice versa. Hopefully you'll hear the logic of it, listen to their logic, and then come back with bombs to refute it.
But, so you've had some of those conversations, I assume.
Yeah, I've had them in the dimension of Bitcoin, but also in the dimension of running an exchange in the crypto space. So there's Bitcoin versus other crypto, Bitcoin, crypto in general, but to me that means Bitcoin versus non-crypto fiat, and also an exchange which is operated in a certain way versus an exchange that operates in other ways. I'll leave it at that in vague terms. So I've had all of those, all interesting.
Yeah, so CoinFloor, I mean, how long has CoinFloor been operating now?
So yeah, we launched in 2013. So it's now approaching 7 years, actually. I think in a couple of months' time, it'll be 7 years it's been operating. So the longest running exchange in the UK, and one of the longest running exchanges in the world, definitely. I think we'll probably be the first 10 of the ones that are still running today. They're probably less than 10 are older than us.
That's amazing, man. So you've been around for Did you found the company?
I was a co-founder, yeah. There was three of us. And also prior to that, I first started looking at Bitcoin in 2011. Remember spending, it was because I was a CTO for many, many years, and so I'm a card-carrying geek, and often the first people to hear about it were people in the tech industry. And so someone knew I was interested in these ideas of completely different ways of living and downloading brains into computers and you know, living in a virtual world, etc. And I'd also created a virtual currency used by 30 million users a few years earlier.
Tell me about that. Let's pause for a second. I want to hear about this. So you made like a Bitcoin based, was it a fork?
No. Well, this is before Bitcoin. This was
no shit. Oh wow.
This is before Bitcoin, but it wasn't the cryptocurrency. It was a digital currency. So I was the CTO and VP of engineering of a virtual world called WeWorld. And we had at peak 30 million users, and it had its own economy. Think of a younger version of Second Life and an older version of Habbo Hotel. We were in the middle. We were like teenagers. 30 million users. Mainly the biggest demographic were female North Americans. So we would have guest stars of guest weemies, we'd call them wee characters. Guest stars of Justin Bieber and so on and so forth. And we had multiple wells and rooms, and then you needed a currency for it. So we created Wii points, and people would do things in the world to earn it, or they could buy it. You know, it was an economy. We'd expect to get a little bit of use, and all of a sudden people were spending 60, 70, 80 hours a week doing stuff in the world to acquire this asset. And we'd, you know, and we would meet up with the people who were running other virtual worlds at the time. So we met up the guys from Habbo Hotel, Club Penguin, all these people. And we were just trying to figure out how could people value this thing which we just created? And they're all wanting to take it outside of the world as well. But there are various laws and regulations that prevented you from taking a product out of the platform. And so it can never run free. And also, how would it work? Because it still would be in the platform because it's operated by your database.
Right.
And then I quit. I went on, became an entrepreneur and started my own businesses. And in the middle of... And so this was a good 4 or 5 years before I became aware of Bitcoin. And in the middle of my second business, a friend forwarded me this link to Bitcoin and said, "I think you'll be interested in this." 2011. I think you'll be interested in this. And for me, this is WePoints, but now in a way where it can work, where anybody can have it. So because I saw the demand and interest for this sort of walled, sort of knobbled, really minimal functionality currency, it was sort of really clear to me that especially for a new generation which was digital first and digital native, that this would make perfect sense. A lot of people had to get their heads around why people would value this. And it's like, well, this is actually money. And people were valuing things that weren't money.
Right.
So, you know, it was really easy to sort of see that. So yeah, that was the history of WeWorld.
That's amazing. So did you get, when you read the white paper, I mean, I know you were primed to kind of understand that digital currencies were like here to stay, and especially in the digital native world, right? But did you realize the importance of the like getting rid of a trusted third party?
Oh yeah. I mean, because we were a trusted third party, and that was where we had all of our problems, all the regulatory issues, all of the problems were related to us, and also all of the hassle. But to be fair, I saw it first as a technical thing, because my background, as I said, was very much a technology background. And so initially in 2011, I was just really interested in it from a technical curiosity point of view. I bought a very small amount, and it didn't cost much. I think it was like £20 at the time, just to play around with it. I didn't really believe that there was going to be this, it would work from an economic point of view. And I was busy working on my business. 2 years later, my soon-to-be co-founder came to me. I'd angel invested in his previous business, And he came to me with this this thing that he discovered while working on that called Bitcoin. And he just became enamored with it. And he was saying, look, we should do something here. There's no one running a well-run exchange in the UK. We should give it a go. And I looked at, okay, let me look at this Bitcoin thing again. And all of a sudden it was hundreds of dollars. And so now I knew that technically I found it very elegant in 2011, but I thought it was just never going to work. And now I saw it had staying power and it'd been increasing. And so I thought, okay, something special is happening here. And then I decided to finish my business at the time. And we founded CoinFloor. And the rest is history.
And we're going to talk about that history, though. So I want to hear more about it. But so has CoinFloor been Bitcoin only from the beginning?
No. Yes and no. Right at the beginning, when we started, there was only Bitcoin.
Right, of course.
So there was, and we were Bitcoin only from the beginning. And for the first couple of years, all was well in the world. I like to say, like there was these various phases of crypto, and I liken it, given my name Obi, to Star Wars, but it was almost like Shar Wars.
Yeah. Different types of
and in the first phase, in the beginning, you know, in the beginning, there was only Bitcoin. And then I remember very well, there was this point where Gavin Andreessen and Mike Hearn had this sort of fateful sort of meetup where they put forward the idea of a benevolent dictator for Bitcoin. And
right.
that's when all hell broke up. And that's when we had this sort of massive war within Bitcoin. And up until then, Bitcoin had like no other cryptocurrency. Every other cryptocurrency was just basically an irrelevance. This sort of civil war allowed space for other cryptocurrencies to effectively gain interest from people. And they took massive advantage of it. Probably the one who took the most advantage was Ethereum at the time. Mm-hmm. But eventually, Bitcoin forked. And we made the call. There was many exchanges that were of the view that we should go with this compromise Bitcoin, which was a compromise between the two sides, called SegWit 2x. And
right, that was the New York Agreement and the lots New of
the New York Agreement. And we were not part of that agreement, and we made a statement that, which was bucking the trend, that unlike many of these others who were signing up to this agreement, we would not sign up to this agreement, and we would just allow the two currencies to list on our exchange, because everybody said we must switch over and just choose one. So we would allow them to switch over our exchange, and the other question of which one would be Bitcoin, we made the call, again different to most of the other exchanges, that the one that would be Bitcoin would be the one that most users believed in, not most miners, because there's a whole miners of the power. It's like, no, we don't really care which one had the most mining power behind it. We had what had the most actual users, and miners are one of the users, but hodlers are users as well, and people who own it are users in combination. And then I think after that, a couple of exchanges decided to make the same decision, and then it was clear that we'd leave it to the market to decide. It split into two, the market decided, and that's when we went from one Bitcoin to two. A little while later, we pushed back against Ethereum for a long, long time. But we did list it at the beginning of 2019 as it was gaining adoption. And I think about 6 months later, Vitalik Buterin made this announcement that Ethereum is going to come out with Ethereum 2. Ethereum is never going to scale. And after pushing back on Ethereum for over a year, then finally launching, acquiescing to pressure to launch, hearing that made us realize that, okay, this is ridiculous. If you as the effectively the head of Ethereum and one of the lead developers on Ethereum, as and others have told us that Ethereum is not good enough and you have to replace it with Ethereum too, then objectively it's not good enough. So very soon after that, we made a decision that we're going to delist Ethereum. And so we had it for less than a year. And the reasons why was we don't need to have a subjective discussion anymore. The actual developers are telling you that it's not good enough. So if I know it's going to be replaced and it's not going to scale and it doesn't achieve its objectives, how in all good consciousness can I list it to have it listed for my customers? Around the same time, we also delisted Bitcoin Cash, because what's really exciting about cryptocurrency is that you have a voting system which works in a completely opposite way of every other form of governance. Normally, you can't be in two places at the same time. Yeah. So you have to decide between two parties in advance and hope, and two manifestos, and hope that you chose the right one. With cryptocurrency, it is one. There's one source of truth, one chain. However, it has the ability to split in two.
Yep.
When it makes sense, and the time it makes sense is when the community wants to diverge into two communities. And so and that's two views. So you're effectively voting, but you vote not only with your hashing power, you also vote with your pocket as well.
Yep, exactly.
Where you decide to store your value, because you can only store your value in one place. So with Bitcoin, when it forks into two, everybody had the same number of tokens. And for an instant in time, both Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash theoretically had the same value. And then the value decided to diverge. And then over the following months and years, you could see how it diverged. And that will tell you what was the right decision, objectively. And now so we also reviewed in 2019 Bitcoin Cash, and we could see that Bitcoin Cash now was worth a fraction of the value of Bitcoin. It was very clear that it lost the vote at this stage. And so we delisted it as well. We went back to being Bitcoin only.
Yeah. So do you see a case in the future where CoinFloor might add cryptos again in the future? Or do you think it's just kind of decided at this point in terms of the money battle, the blockchain crypto money battle?
I like to make our decisions objectively. And objectively, there could, in theory, be a reason why we accept other cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. So we don't make a decision that, you know, we're just going to go with this way and we're never going to change. However, we have four objective criteria that we use to decide on which currencies we list. And if we're going to look at it, the chance that something's going to be able to hit those criteria that's not Bitcoin is pretty close to zero at this stage. So the reason why Ethereum, which was the only one that was anywhere near close, failed was for technical reasons. And that's one of the objective criteria. And it's very hard for us to see how someone else can objectively say Ethereum's good enough when the developers don't say it's good enough. I think that's sort of open and shut. But you have to also look at the level of community support. And there are currencies with a lot of community support, but they're not technically strong. Regulatory clarity, because we are an exchange that is regulated and works within a regulatory regime. So we have to list things that are comfortable from a regulatory point of view. And regulators around the world, in the UK, Europe, and US, have now come out and made it clear that they are comfortable with you listing Bitcoin. There's very few other cryptocurrencies. Most regulators won't name anything by name other than Bitcoin. A couple might name Ethereum, but most won't be comfortable naming. These ones are definitely fine, and all the other ones in this gray area. And then finally, it's quite an important one, but a lot of cryptocurrencies forget this. We believe that we're helping customers store and generate value. We want them to gain. And so if a cryptocurrency believes that its core proposition isn't around helping people generate or store or save value or transfer value, it doesn't make sense for us to list it, because it doesn't fit the use case of what we believe an exchange should be trying to do, to trade things that should be valuable things with each other. So if you take those four, and I think they are four very objective common sense criteria. normally people say they use criteria on what to list. Very few are public about those criteria. And I think the reason why then they're not public about the criteria is simple. If you try to come up with criteria that weren't nonsense, that actually made sense, the only thing that would come up against that objective criteria would be Bitcoin, and everything else should be delisted. Mm-hmm. So you have to say we have criteria, but you're pretty much everything you list will have some exception to any common sense objective set of criteria that you could come up with. So we publish our criteria, and based on those, literally it can only be Bitcoin. And again, as an engineer, I have to say something is not impossible, but we're talking about, just like it's not impossible for, you know, for spontaneously through quantum entanglement, a banana to appear in front of me right now. It's technically possible, but at this point in time, it's highly, highly unlikely.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of a benevolent dictator, I wanted to circle back to that because it's an idea that is common in open source projects.
Yes.
The idea that a project will have a benevolent dictator, like Linus Torvalds, for instance, is the benevolent dictator of Linux. And and the idea is that there's sort of this person, usually it's the founder of a project, that will kind of oversee and coordinate development and make kind of final calls on what gets pushed to, you know, the critical repos of the project, et cetera. And like you said, I think it's an important inflection point in Bitcoin's history that, you know, that Gavin and Mike were trying to arrange or create this kind of arrangement for Bitcoin, which was, like I said, a common arrangement that open source projects used to govern themselves. Mm. But for Bitcoin, it was really important that didn't happen. You were around during that time. What was the pushback against the idea of the particular idea of a benevolent dictator in Bitcoin?
Well, the pushback was slight. I think, depending on who you were talking to. If you were talking to the core developers, people who generally came from a technical background, an engineering background, so who had a lot of experience of open source projects and the benefits and the weaknesses of those, they tended to be more likely to want to push back on that idea. A lot of people who came from the commercial side of things were the ones who were not less likely to push back on that idea, and they wanted to have that idea because they wanted to see progress happen more quickly than it was happening. And they were worried that other people were going to come along and eat their lunch, eat our lunch or eat our breakfast. And that was the concern. However, the debate was polite to begin with, but it got ever more heated because of these differences in philosophy. And ultimately, the view that you needed to do something that didn't have a benevolent dictator won. And I think the reason why is simple at the end of the day. For anything innovative and disruptive to succeed, it needs to be doing something different and new. So what one of the core things that's different and new about Bitcoin is the philosophy. Is the core of the philosophy, we have a system which is effectively, instead of being run by humans, it's being run by code. And so I studied computer science and cognitive science in university. So trying to build our new robot overlords. So yeah. I, for one, welcome our new Bitcoin leader.
Robot overlord.
Our new robot overlord. And because that's effectively what we have with Bitcoin. It's a governance system, which is a piece of code. And it's completely transparent. And its governance system is this, that I'm going to issue a certain amount of Bitcoin to everybody over a period of 140 years. And then I'm going to leave it to people to, from then on, to move money between themselves. And that's it. I'm not going to give any benefits out. I'm not going to charge any taxes. And past that point, there's going to be zero inflation. And that's all I promise you. It's a very clear but it's still a manifesto, effectively, mm-hmm. if you put it in political terms. And if you don't like it, you can create your own company And I can guarantee that every constituent has the exact same assets in this sort of parallel universe if you create a fork. And then you can see if you can try and convince someone else otherwise. Many people have tried and many have failed. And the reason why is because the idea of an incorruptible, completely honest dictator is actually probably the most efficient system you can have. But the problem is, if they're human, it's impossible to be incorruptible and completely efficient. So, but a dictatorship is far more efficient than any other form of government. The only problem is the moral hazard of being a dictator. So right. Bitcoin has the efficiency of a dictatorship without the moral hazard of being human. And therefore, that's what's really powerful about it. It's a completely new form of governance. And if you remove that, then you've removed the thing that's new. You might as well just have a database at that point.
Right, exactly. I mean, the governance model that emerged after that debate, because I think before the Mike Hearn and Gavin Andreessen debate, before the Bcash and block size debate, the governance of Bitcoin was sort of unknown, right? It hadn't played out. It needed to be proven, which how this thing was governed. And so it was a fascinating time in Bitcoin history to me to go back and study. I didn't come in until early 2017. So I saw the end, kind of the resolution of that several years long debate. And it was pivotal in establishing like how Bitcoin is governed, that node operators do have a lot of power, that miners and developers and node operators, sort of the three parties of Bitcoin in terms of like sort of their interests. And the game theory aligns them so well that this conglomerate of Bitcoin businesses who wanted to go a certain way and trying to influence Bitcoin in a certain way weren't able to do that. Because of the, node operators and developers saying, working together, saying, all right, we don't think this is the path to go. Miners who had ostensibly like sort of chosen to go with the businesses, the SegWit 2x path, at least by signaling, eventually we're like, no, all right, we want to be where the users are. we're here to serve the users. So we're going to go that way. And the game theory worked out.
Exactly. I think so. It was... For a certain sort of people, it was very clear this is how it's going to play out. We could have been wrong, but we believed that that was the case. Yeah. So I think it still comes down to a philosophy, because it sort of cryptocurrencies tend to force people into groups of aligned philosophies. Mm-hmm. And so I tweeted this the other day saying I came to Bitcoin because of the technology, and I say things like proof of work and blockchain, block space chain when it was originally, and now it's blockchain, one word. So I came for the technology. I invested due to the economy, and this was the 21 million cap, zero inflation, and then I stayed because of the philosophy. And this is be your own bank and don't trust but verify. And there are many other parts of the philosophy, but that's what was key. This is in 2015, 2016. That's when I started to realize that what's really special about this is it's this unique philosophy. Unique philosophy where you trust others. You don't trust just others, but you trust the code. You learn to self-verify. You have a long time preference. You don't want to just make everything work tomorrow. It's a completely different mindset to how companies work. They work in quarters, how governments work, etc. And that's what's really new. That's what's really powerful about what we do. And the people who've wanted to see that type of world exist now have an opportunity. And they don't want to lose that opportunity. There's no way they're going to keep riding this all the way through to success or die trying. And that's, I think, really key. They're going to, if there are challenges with the code or challenges with the game theoretic elements, the prize of a whole new form of governance is so great that they will adjust those. So although it's actually first, I'm not sure it's immaculate conceptions, because if you look at the Bitcoin Wizards mailing lists and so on, a lot of work has been done to correct bugs and so on. There are many, many bugs in the original code. So there are lots of work done to correct. The aim of the original missile was very good, but it still needs a lot of work to keep it online. Why are people doing that and working for basically for free in most cases? Because the promise and the philosophy is so strong, they're going to make it work. Everybody is a community. Every hodler who makes sure that the price doesn't go down below a certain level, every merchant who accepts it, every core developer working on it is going to make sure that it hits its target no matter what.
Yeah, it's beautiful, man. So this is a topic that comes up a lot, especially on this podcast, because I, you know, have this sort of aspirational, optimistic tone. You know, I call this or talk about the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance a lot, and how Bitcoin will really, I hope, create a better future for us on a global scale in this profound way that seems crazy to most people right now, except for this kind of small group of the hodlers, as you just put it. So has Bitcoin changed you in any way, personally? Have you seen that?
Absolutely. I mean, before, profoundly, actually. That's a great question. I've always had dreams of some of them fantastical, you know, of I felt limited by my own physical body in the sense that fundamentally we are limited by being human beings living in a physical world. Everybody, I think, when they're young, wanted to be a superhero who's invulnerable, who could fly, who could teleport. Many people have had these sort of dreams. And the thing that stop you from doing that is the fact that our physical limitations. And they also lead to other things. They lead to fear. They lead to most problems in the world are the fact that we are physical beings and we live in a world of scarce resources. If you have abundant resources, many of the problems of the world will disappear. So in that same vein, when you see, I've looked for ways of getting us closer to this ideal. And one of the challenges is, you know, the term is, it's the economy, stupid. It comes down to money. It comes down to store of value. A lot of the problems, a lot of inequality in the world comes down to the fact that we have a few people with a lot of power, monetary and economic policy power, and most people who don't. So if you can have a more meritocratic money, then that can take you a step in solving these problems. Not all of them, but it solves a significant subset. Other things may solve problems as well. There's, I think, AI can help, automation and so on can lead to abundance, VR so that we can effectively teleport and fly and experience whole new forms of reality, limited only by our imagination, once we don one of these VR headsets. But in terms of my skill set, in terms of my background, in terms of my capabilities, helping in terms of making Bitcoin a reality is the area where I can provide most value. So I look at and observe what's happening in terms of going to the moon, going to the stars, and VR and AI. But I work day to day in dealing with the problem of money. And the way it's changed me, I mean, it's financially changed me. I wouldn't say I have expletive deletive money yet. money, but I have bugger off money, like sort of somewhere in the middle, you know.
Yeah.
So, and that's a massive thing. It changes your mindset. I'm able to, there's many things, many forms of oppression and issues I've received in my career where you might say be silent to it. Now I can just sort of call out and speak and make sure I have a working environment that I really enjoy, work on things that I'm really passionate about, work with people that are incredible. The people I have to work with are just some of the most amazing people you can imagine. And that's because I'm now filtering for what I believe in and not having to compromise. So that's a massive, massive difference. And that's all brought about because of my involvement in Bitcoin at an early stage. But beyond that as well, philosophically, it's allowed us to test out theories about how we would like the world to work, and we can actually see it happening. So my view about the world has changed massively. I've become a greater believer in the power of technology to affect change. I've become a greater believer of the power of humans to self-organize, to change fundamental, to fundamentally fight against massive oppressive power. And my belief that things that seem to be unchangeable and immutable are actually can be smashed away by a more powerful idea. So I can go on, but yes, it's been profound.
All right. So the natural follow-up question then is, you know, and I agree completely. I'm in the same boat. And everyone that I have interviewed and asked that question of agrees that Bitcoin has personally changed them profoundly. And, you know, for another one that's very common is that people have been very pessimistic about the future, you know, sort of just apathetic because of the, you know, just the lack of privacy that we're seeing, the sort of oppressiveness, the power of the state that seems impossible to overcome, and sort of resign themselves to kind of living these, you know, relatively sort of small lives, smallish lives in terms of like societal impact, and just like, all right, family, you know, my family's important, my family and friends, I'm going to, you know, go and do my work and be on that hamster wheel. And then I'm going to maximize my time with family and friends outside of that. And that was sort of the life that people had, at least that I had, you know, kind of resigned myself to. I had grand visions or like ways that I wanted the world to operate, but didn't have a means, it seemed like, to actually affect that, you know, political action and voting didn't seem to really be doing anything, et cetera. So the cumulative effect then of these individual changes that we see Bitcoin bringing about must have a impact on society. So how do you think, you know, that a Bitcoin-based society would look, you know, differently than today's society?
So I think it's a combination of a number of things coming together. Cryptocurrency is part of it. I mentioned a few others. But the high-level thesis is this, that we want to move towards a post-scarcity society. If it's basically free or near free to deal with the first two rungs on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, so the needs for your basic requirements for food, not an amazing meal, an amazing location, that is elective, so that you should pay for that. But you just know that to be able to eat and to have shelter and safety is basically nearly free. And so the only thing I need to buy is the things that will deepen my relationships with other people or improve myself or improve my self-esteem, etc. And those things are effectively elective. If we know that's where we want to get towards, then I think the key to that is technology. And there's part in multiple areas. You have vertical farming and so on to reduce the price of food production. You have VR, et cetera, to reduce the price of travel. It's great to have a Tesla, but even better if I can don on a helmet and instantly be anywhere in the world with anybody. That's much cheaper, much more efficient. So that's why I think that it's great what's happening with Tesla and SpaceX and going to Mars, but I think the solution is not in outer space, it's in cyberspace. You know, cyberspace, we're limited by our imaginations, not just by the physical world. So it's clearly going to win in terms of expanding our consciousness and our ability to interact and reducing the cost of interacting and travel for at least the basics. But if we then know that we're going to be spending more, and remote working is just accelerating this, but if we know that we're going to be spending more and more of our lives, based on that thesis, in cyberspace, then interacting with people anywhere in the world, then it's going to necessitate a money that allows you to store and transfer value with anybody in a borderless way. And if that's the case, there's only one option. That's Bitcoin. And so, that's key for this to work. Otherwise, if I have to still translate between multiple currencies each time I want to transfer, that's a limitation, that's an inefficiency. Any inefficiency will be replaced by something that's more efficient. And so one digital currency for this new digital world is is an obviously more efficient system to have. And so we will tend to, and it cannot be run by one country. No one country will accept another country running it unless it's a small island or so on. And therefore, it has to be something that has to be the monetary equivalent of Switzerland, completely outside of everything else. Bitcoin is the one. Clearly, Bitcoin is the one. And so Bitcoin plus remote working as standard and as a norm, VR, and automation of certain services, etc., is where we're going to. And that's what I think we'll see this world look like, where you wake up in the morning, you live anywhere you want. In the physical world, you're going to have people around you who you like to spend your, in an American accent, leisure time, we'll say leisure time. Mm-hmm. You like to spend your leisure time with. So it could be friends or close family or people you like to spend time in the physical world and break bread with. And anyone else you want to interact with, you put on a helmet and you're working with people from around the world. You won't know what they look like. You won't know what gender they are. You won't know what age they are. You won't have any mechanism to discriminate. So therefore, other than how well they work, how skilled they are, and the quality of their argumentation, which are the only things you should discriminate, because then it leads to a meritocracy. The best will be at the top. And the other thing, which is common sense to me, is this. If we all want the world to be its best, then the best people need to be doing every single task. I.e., that leads to meritocracy. And so you have to remove any other form of discrimination other than discrimination based on ability. That can only happen in a VR environment. And we see that happening. And so I'm really, really excited. I didn't expect this pandemic to hit, but the effects on society and the acceleration it's causing, I was expecting low time preference. I was happy for this to take 20, 30 years. I'm ready. It's not a problem. But it might take 3, 4, 5 years, which is still, for me is blindingly fast. Someone who's in another cryptocurrency, they want it all to happen next week. But if you're talking about completely changing the basis of money and governance and so on, 5 to 10 years is lightning speed, guys.
It is insane.
Calm down, you know. Keep calm and carry on, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's incredibly fast. But you know, I mean, you're into tech and you understand exponential technologies, and you know, we are sort of piling on those layers of exponential technologies. We have been for, you know, centuries now, and Bitcoin is just another layer on top of the internet, which itself, of course, is an exponential technology built upon, you know, electricity and all kinds of other, you know, exponential technologies. And we have this ability to change, to progress incredibly fast. Like that, we can hit that asymptote of that S curve, like, you know, a lot sooner than we think, and take off, because this thing can be in everybody's hands in the matter of months. It's ready to go. It's ready to roll out. So really it's just waiting for the demand, right?
And I think the demand is there. It's just the demand is just waiting for the technology to get to a certain level of maturity. Because the demand is, do you want your ability to store value to be easier? Do you want to transfer value or receive value from someone else? Do you want that to be easier? Do you want to not have a tax on your, or a tithe on your money by having money that doesn't have inflation? I think if you asked the 7 billion people on the planet that question and explained it to them, I think you'll probably get 7 billion yeses to all three questions. So the demand is everybody on the planet, basically. The only issue is making sure the technology is of a sufficient maturity and it can scale to handle the demand. But because you know everybody wants this when it's ready, you just need to make sure that the steps in the technical steps have been performed in a sensible way. But what we don't want to do is to try and rush, build something that doesn't scale to Earth or galaxy scale now that we have people going intergalactic, or interplanetary, sorry, not intergalactic yet. Give that a couple more centuries. But they're going interplanetary. Unless you have something that scales to that level, it will break when it actually starts to get traction, which is the concern with... Actually, I wanted to just finish back on a previous point as well around, but maybe we should carry on this theme because it's really interesting. But there are other cryptocurrencies which have really, really, really passionate users. Mm-hmm. The problem is, and this is where I don't subscribe to certain cryptocurrencies, is that even if passion is really important, you can correct and you can adjust, but if your fundamental philosophy isn't technically possible, no amount of belief is going to make it technically possible.
Right.
So if you're trying to achieve something which is basically technically infeasible, you can't believe it into being true. So if you, for example, want something to scale infinitely on chain, where everybody has a copy and it's copied to everybody, no amount of belief is going to change the laws of physics. Right. If you want to make a Turing complete smart contract platform, which you know by the halting problem is impossible to prove, because I study computer science, I know it's impossible to prove that this will actually ever be logically bug free, but I want to know it's going to be reliable and I'm handling billions, if not trillions, in terms of value. These are logically incongruous viewpoints. No amount of belief is going to change that view. And so what Bitcoin is trying to do is something that's very simple, very basic. And so technically it seems to, especially with the idea of adding a sense of cost to creating the currency, it seems to have found a solution which solves this very simple but very, very valuable problem without breaking some fundamental law of logic or physics. And that's the thing that's different between it and pretty much every other cryptocurrency. And the ones that don't break any law of physics are nowhere near Bitcoin. And the ones that do seem to be doing well right now, but at some time they'll hit against the laws of physics. And that when they do, or the laws of logic, then they will fail. And people will scratch their heads, why didn't we notice at the beginning? Well, you were being told it again and again and again.
Yeah, so that's why we had to, you know, limit the block size. Why it was so important,
yeah,
is because
you have to start with the technology. Still, it still has to technically be feasible. No amount of belief, but once it's technically feasible, then belief gets you to the rest of the way.
Yes, I get you, man. That's a really good point and a great way to say it. So, all right, we're talking about Bitcoin's viability to scale, and we've chosen this path to scale in layers, which is the proven way to scale a network, right? So, I mean, we have TCP/IP and then HTTP and DNS and everything on top of all of those. And it's a layered system that makes the internet work. And I've been hearing lately this kind of comparing the Bitcoin protocol and the Lightning protocol to TCP/IP, and people calling it LNP/BP, the Lightning protocol and Lightning Network protocol, and Bitcoin protocol as a stack. The next kind of layer, the value transfer stack on top of the internet, which I really like that analogy. And I wonder, like, what do you think of Lightning, and where do you think it is now, and like, what needs to happen in order for it to actually become a viable global payment rail system?
Yeah, that's interesting. Lightning's interesting for me. I'll take a step back. Bitcoin's first and core value proposition is to be a store of value.
Yeah.
And that is in a world where there's a medium of exchange and a store of value, in a world where there is a plethora of mediums of exchange right now, having one more, which is currently slower and less efficient than the existing ones, is not going to be very exciting to a lot of people. But there's actually a dearth. There's not many very good stores of value. And the ones that are the go-to stores of value for people are getting worse every day. So real estate, we have to be very careful what's going to happen to real estate soon. Stock markets, again, overheated. There's a lot of concerns. And we all know about fiat money, i.e. pounds, dollars, euros, and the fact that it's got programmed, almost not programmed in, but it's structurally designed to be inflationary. So in this world where there's three or four very bad, you know, ranging from bad to average getting worse options, Bitcoin is an incredibly good option. And to be able to be a very, very good store of value, we probably don't even need the Lightning Network right now. Because if you think about it, your velocity of the amount of payments or the amount of times you want to spend a good store of value are very low. It's going to be the money of last resort, the thing that you spend after you've spent every inflationary asset you have. And by definition, there's an infinite amount of inflationary assets out there. So it's going to be close to at least, if it's not a cold day in hell, it would be a very, very, very cool day in hell before you should logically spend your Bitcoin, unless there's a mechanism to spend it and immediately recover it. And so you don't reduce your position in Bitcoin if you can, or you have no choice. And that will happen when we get to a point where you're either working, it's either in certain jurisdictions, maybe not legal, and you have no other choice, or you have hyperinflationary money, etc. That's when movement goes over to Bitcoin. But as I said, today, Bitcoin is already good enough to fulfill its core purpose. Now, once that's happened, the next level beyond that is medium of exchange at global scale. And that needs things like Lightning or some alternative. Mm-hmm. Potentially, it could be using sidechains and so on. I find the idea technically of Lightning incredibly interesting and really clever. I think that the level of effort and work that's happening on the Lightning Network, again, is excellent. And there's a lot of people who are adopting it. There are still some question marks, just again, because I have to go back to the pure base technology. And I do have, I still want to, and I keep looking at, want to research how we are dealing with concerns around routing. Because of the fact that you cannot make a connection between any one Lightning node and another without going through intervening Lightning nodes. And there is the amount of Bitcoin that needs to be locked up on any given channel is locked. It can't flow through the network. That can lead to potentially centralizing forces, although trust minimized, which is still much better than a trusted source. But more to the point, it could lead to liquidity traps where money is locked up in here. You have enough value in the network, but it can't get to the person because you can't find the route. So there are things like Lightning Loops and so on, which try to resolve this person's problem, but they sometimes seem to add some level of trust, which concerns me. So I think that it's going to be much better to scale on Lightning than to scale on the Bitcoin network, because we have to make sure that no matter what we do, we cannot lose Bitcoin being a good store of value. I think, though, that I still would like to see more research in how we solve the routing problem. And so we should still look at, while that's happening, I still look at other alternatives, for example, sidechains or temporary sidechains that appear for, you know, are formed for a period of a month or so, and they can grow to a much larger size. But once people then sort of effectively take their Bitcoin back into the main net from the sidechain, that sidechain can be discarded and a new one could be created, for example. That's another idea that's been put forward. Each one has their trade-offs, and I think you're going to have you're going to have a number of different layer twos providing different forms of trade-offs. You have the Liquid network, for example, mm-hmm. Which again has a different set of trade-offs. I don't think it will all be Lightning. I think depending on your trade volumes and your needs and so on, you would use different ones. I think that for retail buying, you know, the proverbial cup of coffee, Lightning will be the one. But if you look on a global scale, the most money is transferred not in normal retail buying cups of coffee. It tends to be larger, big bulk amounts. So you need to have a solution for that as well. And Lightning won't solve that. And you probably won't
when you get to global scale, want to do that on Bitcoin either. You want to do it on a side chain or something.
Yeah. All right. Another tech question for you, since you have the tech background, I want to take this opportunity. Taproot is, looking more and more likely to be soft forked into Bitcoin Core, sooner than later. The BIP's been around for a long time. It's been well discussed, well tested, thoroughly tested. And it's actually a relatively simple bit of code, but it will unlock. It's very clever code, but it's in terms of the number of lines, it's actually pretty small. But it's going to unlock quite a few other potential upgrades to the network. What is your take on Taproot, its importance, and like what it can do for Bitcoin on the base layer?
Yeah. Taproot and around the same time, Schnorr signatures and the combination there is a lot of excitement. One, greater expressiveness in terms of the types of smart contracts that you can produce. Also, greater privacy, because that's one of the biggest focuses from my observations of the Bitcoin Core developers' work is that they try to quite cleverly solve multiple problems in parallel. So every, because they understand that they are still at the end of the day, servants of the community. Anything they produce, they're humble enough to offer it to the community and in the hopes that the community accepts it and adopts it, node operators download it, miners download it, etc. And to maximize the chance of that, they want to make sure any changes are massively has a really good return on investment. So it doesn't just provide the scaling offering, but it also hopefully improves privacy and maybe provides more functionality, etc. And Taproot and Schnorr are cases in point. I'm like 95% really excited about these. There are a couple of really interesting discussions about edge cases that I've spent a little bit of time looking at. But again, I'm so one of the edge cases that has been put forward is there's a potential that this could make creating quantum proofing Bitcoin more difficult, some of these changes, than our current system. And so that, I need to read into that more, but I remember someone posting up an article about that recently, because up until that point, the general perception was that this is basically a zero compromise, just wholly potentially beneficial change.
Right.
And if something's a wholly beneficial zero compromise change, I'm all for it.
Of course.
and also we're dealing with the theory of quantum proof, is that going to even be a concern, an issue? It's just that the extent of research into how to quantum proof Bitcoin with this additional functionality is less mature than for our existing systems. So that's the only area I would. I like to be pragmatic in any decision I make, but I still think that it's highly likely to be accepted, I'm really excited to see what's going to be invented or what's going to be put in place as a result of it being about.
Yeah, me as well. Well, let's finish up by circling back to CoinFloor. I'd love to hear about where you see CoinFloor going in the future, and in particular. In my work with Swan, obviously Swan is, dedicated to recurring buys, to dollar cost averaging, and as a kind of a best practice. I know that CoinFloor has the same services. So one, where is CoinFloor going? Two, how do you see the importance of increasing and encouraging, especially Bitcoiners and new coiners who will be coming in during this next run, hopefully, toward DCA and dollar cost averaging?
Yeah, so we're an exchange, so we have a range of services, but we made a decision at the beginning of this year that we would offer a retail offering. We, up until the time, we'd focus on institutional and sophisticated investors and traders. And the reason why was because we didn't feel comfortable offering a product to retail. We felt that the space wasn't mature enough and that wasn't something we wanted to do. At the beginning of this year, we felt when we looked at DCA, this was an offering that we think made sense for the mass market. One of the biggest concerns that people that we talked to had was the volatility of the price. Not the 1% who were like to speculate,
but the 99% who were much more interested in investing for the long term. And so we came up in the past with the ideas of physically deliver futures for the big players out there. But we realized that for someone just coming in and wanting to buy Bitcoin, you didn't need a complex solution. If you bought regularly the same amount, that effectively protects you from that. Mm-hmm. And now, if you want to trade, you can. But if I'm going to promote something for retail, it's only going to be this regular offering. And it's only going to be something that they can do very, very simply. In our case, straight from their own banking app. They don't have to even log in. Once they've set up the account, they don't have to log into the account, to our account, to effect a Bitcoin purchase, whether it's a one-off purchase or what we recommend, the regular, you call it dollar cost averaging, we call it auto buying. Mm-hmm. In terms of where we see this going, we're really excited. Just in fact, just today, there's a newspaper called the Daily Express here, which is one of the more well-known tabloids newspapers. So it's a mainstream newspaper, and they've done this full article on one of our customers. The reason why they did that write-up and we were excited about it was that this customer represents the new face of Bitcoin. She's someone who's recently retired. She didn't have a smartphone until the end of, till the beginning of this year. So she wasn't technical, but she saw that her capital in her bank account was not gaining any value and in fact was losing value. She could see, and everybody else can see now, that you have governments around the world printing money. And she could see that this is not going to end well based on her life experiences and the advice of her parents as well. And she's come from a background of regular saving, right, as opposed to the last sort of 20 or 30 years where we were taught to just spend, don't regularly save, etc. If you went back further than that, people were taught to regularly spend, save now, and get gratification later. And so there's this massive alignment we're seeing, and that's leading to people investing in things like gold and silver as well. But it's also leading people to invest in Bitcoin because they see it as the future of gold. It's taking the place of what gold used to do. She explains this incredibly eloquently, and this is why it was written up. But we see more people like that, not the 1%, but the 99% coming on board. I mean, we're part of the 1%, and it's great having conversations with other people in the industry or in the space who are really passionate about Bitcoin. What really gets me excited is when someone comes in new and is talking to me about this and they're getting it day one, even before they've come on board, and they've already got the concepts because of all of the education that we're doing, that you guys are doing at Swan and Swan Signal, that 21ism are doing, Citadel 21 and Jameson Lopp with his education resources, Bitcoin Q&A, and there's many others. And this, so we've got this sort of, I call it this Bitcoin Jedi, just educating people, and it's getting out there through memes, through Twitter, and it's seeping into the general consciousness. And then our job now is when they come on board, just to take them towards a path which is a simple, clean, and the safest possible way of investing in Bitcoin. And so they maintain that sort of good impression of Bitcoin, and they start to learn the right philosophy from the get-go. Exactly. And so that's our objective. It's very simple, and we just rinse and repeat. We're not going to try and do 100 different things and then sort of clutter the entire site with many offerings. We do one thing, we do it really well, and we keep it really simple.
Man, we're thinking the exact same thing over here. So I'm love to connect with you and hear that because we're convicted about the same exact thing in that way. And I think it's going to be really exciting to see in the next year and a half as price goes up as we expect it will, based on the halving cycle and new people and new attention are coming in, that they're being steered toward products like this and then slowly being educated about what's going on here. And instead of, going to a place like Coinbase where, you might buy in some Bitcoin, but then you're going to be marketed to like check out this other coin and that coin so they can make some trading fees, et cetera. So it's just a business philosophy and model that is aligned with the purchasers, the retail investors' best interests. And then I think it's just the right way to do business.
Yeah, I think unfortunately there are a number of exchanges. Coinbase is one which lists a plethora of cryptocurrencies. Now, it depends on the market they are trying to aim for. If you're aiming for this highly sophisticated market and they understand the risks and they've got Bitcoin and they're happy to trade these other cryptocurrencies and speculate on them to try and earn more Bitcoin, which is right, the strategy of a lot of people, then fine. And caveat emptor, buyer beware, trader beware, but you can try that. You could also go to a casino and do the same thing. It's effectively the same, but there's nothing wrong with that. However, if you dress it up as this safe offering and you're thinking of your customer and you're thinking of the long-term investor and you're not saying that this is actually a place to go off and gamble, that's where there's a problem. There are many sites out there, very high leverage, lots of trading, but they make it clear that this is a place really to gamble. It's when they're trying to say this, it's something other than it is that I take exception. And I really think they're doing their customer disservice, because in most people's cases, it's best for them to save regularly. It isn't best for them to trade. And to make it sound like in most people's cases, it is best for them to trade, that's where the problem is. We say, we have a trading subpart where we say, you should be investing most. We ask the question, should you be trading? And the question is, the answer is, if you're asking this question, the answer is probably no.
Right.
That's our answer to it. It's simple. The answer is probably no. And we say all these risks with trading. And then we say, look, if after hearing all of this, you either a professional trading, you're comfortable trading, or you're still excited about the idea of learning and improving, then great, trading's for you.
Yeah.
But you need to hear all this first before I start directing you straight towards trading.
Absolutely.
Also, it's a free world. You should be allowed to do what you want, but you definitely need to be given the right, fair, honest information. And that's what's sorely missing.
Yeah.
Not with you guys, by the way, but in many parts of the space.
Yeah, I agree completely. Man, this has been a fantastic conversation. I've been wanting to meet you for quite a while. I appreciate your time. This was a lot of fun.
Great. Great to meet you, AT.
Thanks to Obi for joining me. Find him on Twitter @Obi. Man, he must have been on Twitter really early to get a 3-letter handle. You can find me on Twitter @CitizenBitcoin. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. Share this one with family and friends. The bull is coming. Get them on board. Sign them up for Swan. Use your referral code. Sign up for it at swanbitcoin.com/enlist. You'll get a special referral URL like swanbitcoin.com/Brady. You can check it out. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring the episode and to Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the podcast in their feed. You can check out my merch shop at layer1btc.com. Click on partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. There's cool stuff there to check out. Hey, dude, I've seen a couple of listeners tweet out that they have Citizen Bitcoin shirts. It's really cool. Like, I love that. So grab that. There's also some OPSEC friendly stuff there too. It supports the show and a great Bitcoin only business, Layer One. Shout out Nick Ward, the designer and proprietor of that business.
Also, check out the podcast I've created for Swan, the Swan Signal podcast. It's an audio archive of our weekly Swan Signal Live broadcasts. We've been having some incredible guests on that show, producing some amazing episodes. Check it out at swansignalpodcast.com. And if you like YouTube, you can check us out on youtube.com/swansignal. If you have any questions for me, please, please feel free to reach out. I love to hear from you all. My DMs are open on Twitter. That's the best way to get to me. You can also DM me on Telegram. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin there as well. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.